So we're now out to recruit 10 fellows from around the world who already have subject matter specialties, graduate degrees or professional experience in something, and who aren't yet journalists but who want to be journalists. So starting in September 2012, we will bring them here, and in 8 months, we'll give them a head start covering their own disciplines for media around the world. To do this, we're building the program jointly with CBC News, with the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, Post Media Network, and the Thomson Reuters Foundation. And we're also working with the Financial Times, the BBC, the Washington Post, and openfile.ca, which, as you probably know, is a great Toronto-based startup. Our fellows will spend most of their time in the program covering their specialties as stringers for those news organizations, while we also coach them on writing, on technology, on research, on interviewing, on entrepreneurship, and on global affairs. So if you're interested in this, and I'll stop talking about it, but if you're interested in this or if you know someone who might be, please come and speak to me after the program and pick up one of our flyers. It's out of the registration desk right outside. The fact is that we're only able to do this program because Toronto is particularly blessed as a center for journalism, really in the global plane. Our media here understand that journalism is two things right now. It is, first, an ongoing commitment to a constant idea that a journalist is anyone who in lifetime helps deepens an audience's honest understanding of the people or circumstances around them. And at the same time, our media companies in this city understand that the methods of journalism have themselves become an experiment. A lot of other media hubs in the world are running scared right now, and you can feel it when you visit them in London or New York. And it's telling that Toronto is actually less scared than a lot of those other places. And no other organization, I think, better epitomizes that combination of boldness and rootedness than the Canadian Journalism Foundation itself. We've had the huge privilege of working with CJF to think through this curriculum, and I owe a particular thanks to Natalie Turvey, who's sitting in the front row, and to past chair John McFarlane. But more importantly for tonight, we've also worked with CJF to bring you this lecture over the course of the past 6 years. Together, we brought Mayor David Miller, Senator Hugh Siegel, Lieutenant General Andrew Leslie, Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin. And each time, this lecture opens a new conversation about democracy and journalism that is both bold and deeply rooted in values that we share. We're especially lucky that today's lecture takes place under the aegis of CJF's new chair, Bob Lewis. The CJF is only the latest step in Bob's remarkable career at the van of Canadian journalism. He ran Maclean's magazine as managing editor and then editor-in-chief between 1993 and 2000. He spent more than 20 years at Maclean's before that. He launched the Content Development Bureau of Rogers Media in 2001 and was at Rogers until 2005. And before all of that, he'd been a correspondent for Time Life, and he started the Montreal Star. Bob was also a founding member of the Canadian Journalism Foundation, and in all of these roles, I know by reputation, a real champion of the nexus upon which we are focused tonight, which is the place where democracy supports journalism and journalism deepens democracy. Bob, thank you for allowing us to co-host this lecture with you. Please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming your co-host, Bob Lewis.
Thank you, Rob. That's very kind, exceptionally kind. Ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a welcome to you on behalf of CJF, and it's wonderful to be partnered with Monk once again for the annual lecture. Democracy and journalism is something that we spend a lot of time focusing on at CJF, either in our monthly forums, which we have, or on our websites, French and English websites, and executive training programs. At the last forum we did, we had a poll that Ipsos Reid did for us. It looked at the whole issue of whether or not journalists should be more accountable. The stunning thing to me about the poll was that 40% of the people said that journalists in Canada practiced phone hacking and paid police for tips. And another 40% really weren't sure one way or the other. And 56% of the people polled, this is an online survey of 1,000 people, said that there should be some outside body that regulates journalists. So it's not news to us that that our stars have dimmed. I think there's a lot of public skepticism and worse about journalism. I know that we're right down there, and I'm reading from an Ipsos Reid survey. I'm not really flagging or slagging anybody. We're right down there with car dealers, national politicians, CEOs, environmental activists, new home builders, and union leaders. We're ahead of them, actually. The bad news, Christine, is that journalists and lawyers are sort of tied just above them. And the good guys are soldiers, pharmacists, doctors, airline pilots, teachers, police officers. I can't think of anybody better to address this whole issue of democracy and journalism than our distinguished speaker tonight, Christine Silverberg. Her career in policing and public safety has spanned some 30 years. She retired in the fall of 2000 after a five-year term as chief of the Calgary Police Service. In the last 11 years, Christine has managed a diverse civil litigation practice. She specializes in regulatory investigations and proceedings, but her work also embraces employment and labor law, policing law, corporate governance, Aboriginal law, family law, conflict resolution, and she has represented victims of criminal harassment and stalking and domestic violence, subjects that, alas, are once again back in the news involving the RCMP. Christine was raised on a dairy farm outside of Brampton. Her mother, a Yorkshire war bride, told her she could do anything she wanted to do. She didn't, in fact, realize, she said, that there were people who didn't think women should be police officers until she actually joined a force. After graduating from Glendon with a sociology degree, she went to work as a correctional officer at the newly opened Vanier Center for Women near Brampton. There she heard that the Mississauga Police Service was looking to hire women because the male police officers were having to dress up as women for undercover activities. She rose through the ranks quickly. She obtained an MA in criminology from the University of Toronto. After a several-year stint with the Ontario Solicitor General's Department, she returned to policing as deputy chief of the Hamilton-Wentworth Regional Force. She created a real stir when she landed in Calgary, obviously, as chief in 1995. She was an outsider, a woman, and that put her in the spotlight. At the time, only 8% of sworn officers on the Calgary Police Force were women, and the research I saw today indicated that when she retired, that had more than doubled. She was known for pushing for diversity and reaching out to the diverse and different communities. And instead of signing on for another 5 years, she decided to try something else. And so at 51, she started law school at the University of Calgary, where she obtained her LLB. She also has her professional accreditation in public relations and certifications from the Ontario and Canadian Police Colleges and the FBI's National Institute. In addition, Christine is a graduate of the Business Executive Program at Queen's. She's been in the practice of law for the last 11 years, as I indicated, and while she maintains a healthy interest in police matters, she's not here tonight to talk about or comment on police matters, although I know she has plenty of opinions about them. Rather, she's going to focus on two controversial areas: the way women, especially women leaders, are portrayed in the media, and the importance of public trust, both for the police and for journalists. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Christine Silverberg.
I'm really delighted to be here. It is an honor for me to have been asked. I was rather surprised because I thought, what on earth could I say after having retired for 11 years? But I'm not really opposed to answering questions either about policing, but I do become concerned about the fact that in the kind of profession that I've been in, and even now, I am concerned about the fact that there would be a suggestion that any comment I might make was in some way attempting to be critical, and that's not what I want to do or why I'm here. So if later when you ask me questions, I'm happy to talk about my views and the processes that I think would work in various situations, but don't ask me about what I think about what Chief so-and-so or Commissioner so-and-so did, because I'll say, well, why don't you ask that person what they think about it? So I think that's what you meant, but I certainly don't mind talking about general policing topics. So when I accepted the invitation, I underscored that any views that I might share this evening really are my own. Yes, as a retired chief of police of a major Canadian city, having spent, as you know, some 30 years in the policing profession, but also now a lawyer and someone who very much believes in openness and transparency. So my experiences are my own, and my views are not to be confused with any serving or former Canadian police chiefs. Whatever opinions and insights I have really are from my unique perspective, and it is a perspective born of the breadth and depth of experience that really is singularly mine. And I chuckle a little bit when I say that, because I don't think anyone ever confused my views with those of my colleagues. My career was different from most, and to point out the rather more obvious, my gender was different as well. So over the early years in policing, I developed two maxims which ultimately influenced who I was and what I did as an officer and leader. First, I came to believe very strongly that what goes on inside a police organization is reflected in how police actually deliver service. In other words, the excellence with which policing is provided is dependent upon the excellence within. And the excellence within was very much about infrastructure, of course, but more about, from my perspective, removing the systemic barriers and designing systems that really truly could value diversity. So my mantra over the years became policing from the inside out, because I knew from all of my own experiences that the organizational design and systems development were critical if there was ever really to be a true change in policing. Secondly, I became very focused in my career on who the police actually serve. And as a result, I became very committed to notions of community policing and public trust. So these two precepts, policing from the inside out and building the public trust, are really the foundation of who I am and the way in which I see institutions and the world. They are the principles that shape all I do, even in the practice of law. And so it ought not to come as a surprise that they also shape my views of the institutions that are contiguous to media delivery and in the molding of those who decide to report the news, or decide and report the news. This evening, I want to talk about two specific issues. First, the creation and perpetuation of gender stereotypes by the media, and secondly, media and the public trust. So the first I'm just going to talk on briefly, and the second a little more expansively. As I said, my experiences in policing, my personal experiences in policing shaped my leadership, and those experiences were of a woman in policing during a time when it was rare to see women in the profession, never mind in the senior ranks. And a gender focus was never far away, and so it was as well when I was chief of police and the center of some considerable media attention. What I was wearing always seemed to be newsworthy, sometimes more so than my position on the issues. I learned early in my tenure that the choices made by the media in their descriptions of me sometimes tended to marginalize and trivialize important policing issues. For example, when the late hours I kept became public knowledge, the discourse was about the effect on my children, not on, for example, my dedication to my responsibilities or the crisis of the day. I raised, and by the way, both of my children are fine young adults now pursuing second degrees and careers and very happy, and notwithstanding all the trouble of the teenage years, which everybody has, but there was always a focus on whatever it was that I was doing, how was it affecting my children? I raised with members of the media at times what I thought was a preoccupation with the more familial and personal, but the refrain I got was that there was a curiosity about me. People wanted to know about me because it was history in the making. For me, though, it was more often style over substance. And while I understood the need to be personified, after all, the public do want to know who's leading their police service, the lack of balance meant that I had to fight hard to persuade that I was tough and not soft on crime, for example. There was an assumption that I was soft on crime. This didn't seem to be such an issue when I was addressing things like domestic violence or child abuse or victim reparation or prostitution strolls, because for some, wrongly, I think, those are considered soft issues. The problems arose when I was addressing issues such as gang violence or organized crime, and I felt as though I had to always overstate the points just to get them heard. The difficulty, I think, is that by a pattern of media coverage that is stereotypical, where men are often depicted as strong and women as sensitive and therefore perhaps weak, there is a sidelining of potentially very important issues for public debate. On more than one occasion, I was told, "You don't look like a chief." And my response always was, "And what does a chief look like exactly?" I was described in one national magazine as leading the Calgary Police Service with guts and glitz, and in another publication as an alluring chief. The language itself shifts attention away from what the chief is doing or what the chief is saying to how it was said and what she looked like when she was saying it. The focus on gender, then, was very much a part of the landscape when I was chief from 1995 to 2000, and I frankly don't believe that there's been great strides in the 11 years since. My interest in how women leaders are presented in the media has never waned. When the public reporting about a woman in power is positioned not on an institutional landscape but on a gendered landscape, it has an impact. Yes, there is strong interest in the personal life of any public figure, and you're not immune from criticism, even harsh criticism. But I think there are two issues. First, to what extent and under what circumstances are the private lives of public figures actually in the public interest? And secondly, gendered reporting creates its own set of challenges, both on an individual level, as it did when I was chief, but also on a societal level. By perpetuating stereotypes, if even unconsciously, the media assume a powerful social agentry role. On an individual level, if one's to survive such differential treatment, it causes you to think strategically, to try to stay 10 steps ahead all of the time, to minimize any damage, to reposition, to get the real story out, to keep your agenda on track, and not have it set for you by the things that are going on and to correct course. But by the media often shrouding my actions with a veil of gender and politics, the potential always existed for my real motivation as chief of police to be lost in the public eye, and this always concerned me, and it made me work harder. Let me give you a specific, though I grant you a seemingly innocuous sort of example of gendered reporting, or at least what I perceive as gendered reporting. I had, it was said with some equivocation, 4 personal bodyguards at all times. They apparently did my laundry, they stopped to buy me pantyhose on the way to engagements, and they were my boy toys, or at least those were the undercurrents and often said. It was also frequently said that if I wasn't a woman, I wouldn't need bodyguards, but the myth that I was surrounded by these 4 testosterone-driven males became legendary. There were editorial cartoons showing my supposed 4 bodyguards hanging off the wings of the plane when I took a flight with the Snowbirds one afternoon. For me, the term was always bodyguards. For the other major city chiefs in Canada, security was the word of choice. Indeed, another chief of police from Eastern Canada, who had been following what was fast becoming national news at the time, called me to see if he could speak out on my behalf about the need for security. I declined because I thought it would be perceived somehow as though I needed Big Brother to help me out when I was attempting to build my own credibility, personal presence, and performance. But bodyguard has a different ring to it than security. It invokes, to some extent, I think, a picture of a helpless, if not a hapless, woman. How could such a person be in charge, be in command? It seemed to be the legend that was important. I suppose that publishers would say the matter was one of resource allocation and therefore of some public importance, although I don't recall that that was actually ever posed to me. The difficulty, from my perspective, was twofold. First, the whole reportage was highly gendered, but secondly and importantly, there were no serious attempts to seek out my views or accurately report the matter. I don't want to digress into why it might have been necessary to have officers in a large city police organization trained in VIP security in order to respond as circumstances fluctuated for me or others. But for the record, any security I had on public appearances was directly related to threat assessments that had been conducted. I only want to make the point by way of this example that it's one thing trying to respond to something like that on the basis of resource allocation, for example, if that was the true motivation, but it's quite another to layer on that and battle the gender implications that go along with it. Now, lest you think I stand here complaining, please let me assure you that I'm not. I speak purely in this forum to the complications arising when the media propagate a gender-differentiated picture, when, as the saying goes, you're just trying to do your job. I knew, though, that how I was described by the media in this fishbowl of mine may be the message ultimately received by the public about me. My public persona was created largely by journalists and commentators and columnists, and therein the media have significant control. Perhaps that's why I came to believe so fervently in face-to-face relationships, why I spent so much time in and amongst all the communities of Calgary, in and amongst all the members of the police service, and yes, the media as well, so that they could directly see who I was. This was important to me because for the first 2.5 years, I was embroiled, through no fault of my own, frankly, in a contract skirmish between the police commission, here called police services boards, and the city. Rumors and gossip abounded, and rumors and gossip can be quite sinister. Worse still, when the media report on them with no heed to the notion of responsible journalism, which has happened from time to time. Indeed, there were times during my tenure that I was worried about the daily exposés that were coming out during that contract time. It would create a perception in the minds of the officers and members of the public that the chief's focus was on personal matters and not on their welfare. It wasn't as though people in Calgary knew who I was. After all, I'd spent my career in policing in Ontario and had only moved to Calgary when I was appointed chief. Thus, what the media reported was critical to the public's perception of me. I learned as chief, at the end of the day, the media stories never could rise in importance above the pursuit of your goals, but I can tell you that it takes a lot of stamina to keep it in perspective. The higher road and the moral plane is always the best. Being dragged into controversy, being dragged into some smear campaigns, of which I can tell you of many, being prey to one-sided stories can divert your focus and ultimately your abilities to succeed. One national columnist who I assume was following many of the published reports of Calgary's chief of police wrote a column in 1997, 3 years into my tenure, in which she said this: "The looming gray weight filling the scenery around the city's first female police chief is gender. It is lugged to every meeting and confrontation, every carefully worded statement from detractors. It is a battle she can't and won't fight, but it is the battle against chimeras faced by every woman who dares challenge the accepted order." And a CBC commentator at the time opined, "She doesn't act like a woman or a civic employee who knows her place and demurs to authority. She appears to be her own person, as comfortable in a police uniform as she is in a cocktail dress. Maybe that's what upsets. She is a woman with power who isn't afraid to be womanly. She seems effortlessly to combine the heroism of a police officer with a keenly felt interest in the community at large." My point in raising the issue of gender is not specifically for the gendered reporting I've encountered, which was manifest, but because of two deeper concerns that are reflected by it. First, the media must grapple with its very real power in perpetuating and shaping culture and society, in shaping the very consciousness of communities, and in shaping public opinion. Any institution that holds such remarkable power must be accountable. Acknowledging and understanding the impact of gendered reporting in reinforcing or shaping culture is important, but recognizing when it occurs in the first place is an important first step in developing a culture of accountability within media organizations. Secondly, and aside from the matter of gendered reporting, is rationalizing the extent to which the private lives of individuals are indeed in the public interest. On the one hand, we rail against any restraint on those core values of freedom of expression that underlie our democracy, and we applaud the role of the media in the pursuit of truth about all things. Freedom of the press, after all, is at the heart of our democratic society. But how do we decide whether something about the personal lives of a public official is a matter of public interest in the first place, whether it's nothing more than some prurient interest, whether it somehow affects the very lives of the citizenry, and whether there might be some moral or social duty by the media to report or generate debate about it? Moreover, who decides? What are their obligations? And how is the balance determined between the public's right to be informed and individuals' privacy rights? All of these questions lead me to talk about the public trust, but before we do, I want to show you a few slides that will underscore the matter of gendered reporting. They're editorial cartoons that appeared in the Calgary newspapers. That was just right after, or right on the point of me appointed. They're the bodyguards. No, you could interpret this in a number of ways. Either I'm cleaning house, or I'm sweeping the streets clean of criminals, or something. But the problem is how many people view this kind of I don't think I look like that. Anyway, we see the term public trust in relation to public institutions, government, health, education, to name a few, and yes, policing. The term, I think, has become so popular in some quarters that there's a risk that the term the public trust or the community trust will be relegated to just some kind of flavor of the month. That would be a serious mistake, however, as there is nothing in my view that is more important to the delivery of policing services today than that it is supported by the trust of diverse communities. There must be broadly based confidence in the ability of the police to deliver its services ethically, in a transparent and publicly accountable way, and with a leadership that is dedicated to earning that trust. And there are parallels with the delivery of media services. Over the years, through the practice of policing and the study of criminology and the practice of law, I've come to several conclusions about the public trust. First, the public trust raises the idea, at least ethically, if not in law, that the relationship between the institution and the public is a fiduciary one, a relationship in which the well-being of the community is held in trust for current and future generations. As an ethical fiduciary, as I call it, the police owe a duty of care to the community, a duty founded on honesty and integrity, diligence, and even-handedness in approach. Equally, the media owe the public a duty of care, a duty, yes, founded on honesty and integrity, diligence, and even-handedness. My second conclusion about the public trust is this: building or restoring and retaining the public trust depends on three key approaches. First, a culture of accountability within the organization or institution. Two, understanding the central role of leadership, including governance. And three, embracing a spirit of transparency and taking responsibility for ethical decision making. The third thing that I learned, or conclusion I came to about the public trust, is that the discipline or sanction process should be a mechanism of final resort. It is not an end in itself. True public accountability rests on the connectivity of all the parties, where governing authorities aim to establish ethical services, where leaders are responsible for leadership and inculcation of core values, and where practitioners are personally responsible for engaging in ethical behaviors towards those they serve as well as those with whom they work. My fourth conclusion about the public trust is this: the excellence with which services are delivered derives from the excellence within. Building such internal excellence requires competent and sustained leadership at the executive level, a leadership that is both knowledgeable about organizational systems and processes, as well as the art and craft of the profession. The commonalities in our institutions, I think, are these. One, our respective institutions, police and media, operate in a highly contextual milieu, often a highly emotive atmosphere, in a context wherein which there are differing views of the role and mandate of the press, and in an environment that can be ambiguous. In such a milieu, there is little consistency and less constancy to the public perception of the scope or depth of the services provided or the manner in which they are delivered. The challenge, I think, is in being responsive to the shifting tides of public opinion and managing the often changing and competing expectations of diverse communities, while at the same time retaining independence. We know that the media is a powerful influencer. It has the capacity to influence politics, culture, and society in numerous ways. Thus, it becomes critical as to how media accesses information, how media interprets the confluence of information and diversity of sources, and how the production of media is funded. This transparency is critical given the media's pervasive influence to affect public opinion. Certainly, while policing and other professionals can be held accountable in numerous ways, including by the media, it is terrifying to come across a journalist who is in the so-called pocket of an individual leaking stories of questionable credibility, all for some self-gain. And it does happen, and it has happened in my career. Two, public perception is both a driver and a challenge. There is a dichotomy that arises in public sentiment towards our institutions. Whether a rights-based culture or a freedom-based culture, that culture drives public perceptions as to what is considered just treatment. We are each applauded in our roles, but criticized when there is a perceived or actual abuse of power. This dualism is especially true when any public views our actions as discriminatory and thus a violation of the principle of even-handedness that's so much a part of the public, a foundation of the public trust. As you heard earlier, just last month, the Canadian Journalism Foundation reported on an Ipsos Reid poll in which fully 40% of Canadians said that the Canadian media used tactics like phone hacking and paying police for tips in pursuit of stories. It does not matter how actually distant the international hacking scandal is or was, the perceptions of the public pose a challenge to the media in the same way as perceptions of corruption or abuse, for example, pose a challenge to the police. Thirdly, diversifying, and when I say thirdly, I'm referring back to the ways in which I think that there are parallels in our institutions, the commonalities of our institutions. So thirdly, diversifying methodologies, not altering values, is key to the delivery of public services. In an era of terror where there is increased power given to policing authorities by the state, and where freedoms are frequently restricted for the very purpose of ostensibly protecting those freedoms, there lies enormous risk of fractioning a community. The risk is amplified when one or more parts of a community or agency or institution rationalizes or justifies their excesses on the basis of the greater good. In such a means versus ends context, our impartiality and adherence to core values is often questioned. In such a world, we come under intense scrutiny. Public perceptions are influenced by not just what is happening in one's own community, but around the globe. And our respective ability and capacity to build and sustain community trust is often shaken. The public trust is not a partisan concept, and building it or restoring it means understanding diverse perspectives and delivering different, though equitable, services in the circumstances. Delivering such services requires an institution flexibly organized and poised to respond to change and crisis by diversifying their methodologies, not altering their values. Fourthly, accountability operates at two levels, individual and institutional. We only have to witness some developments in North America and internationally to underscore the fact that the public will not tolerate real or perceived threats of injustice, any kind of corruption, abuse of power, or political influence from an institution that affects their daily lives. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about the institutions of policing or journalism. In some cases, elaborate procedures and systems are developed to ensure such issues are properly addressed. Aside from any criminal, civil, or administrative action which is taken in such individual cases, policies and standards are often articulated to prevent recurrence. Governance, however, which is merely reactive to public complaint, whether in your business or mine, neglects the role of institutional accountability in the broader accountability framework. When any one of us in a leadership position takes disciplinary or employment-related action against a recalcitrant police officer or journalist, but fails to examine the systems and the processes that gave rise to the conduct in the first place, there has been an institutional failure to reassure the public that underlying causes are being addressed. In the same poll that I mentioned earlier, 56% of Canadians believe that Canadian journalists should be accredited by some form of industry-wide standards body. The public needs assurance that they can trust the very people who provide and shape our existence. Intuitively, for example, the public knows that good police work is not simply a series of independent police actions, but a complex network of interrelated individual behaviors and organizational processes. So too, the misconduct of a police officer or journalist is generally not perceived by the public to be an isolated event, but rather the result of organizational systems that have somehow gone awry. In the final analysis, it is a combination of personal, organizational, and situational factors that affect decision making. It is a combination of those same factors that are at the root of misconduct and institutional corruption. As individuals in our professions, we can apply our wide margin of discretion in highly constructive ways or in highly destructive ways. But focus on individual control of misconduct or waywardness, while clearly critical as part of the broader scheme of accountability, becomes a panacea that falls short of addressing the underlying symptoms. Fifthly, the public trust is earned in the here and now. A police chief does not have the luxury of waiting weeks for an investigation report or years for inquiry recommendations. Part of earning the public trust is decisive action taken in the here and now. And this is always a risky business for the chief of police trying to stay ahead of news reports. Without taking those risks, however, informed by experience and bolstered by a very close connection with and reputation in the community, a chief of police will be faced with a decided deterioration in the public trust. The role of the media in these cases can be instrumental in building or shaking confidence in the leadership of police organizations. Let me take an example of a police officer involved in a fatal motor vehicle collision. Police leaders are often appear in public to address such a tragic collision or a high-speed chase, a police shooting, or some revealed corruption, and simply state, when they're before the media, "I have ordered an immediate investigation into the incident and surrounding circumstances. As the matter is under investigation, I am restrained from commenting further. Our sympathies go to the loved ones of all who died." Such a response does little to engender public trust. For starters, compassion for the victim and the family takes precedent, but there is nothing wrong with a police chief talking about how the investigation will proceed, what elements will be canvassed, what the time frames are, and other such details. The police chief must simultaneously respond internally to deal with whatever policies, systems, and processes that shaped the misconduct or led to the accident, and externally to demonstrate that the police understand their duty to the community and will be held accountable both as an institution and as individuals for their conduct. Conveying these sentiments and commitments to the community cannot be done without honest, forthright, and transparent approaches. And trust me, good journalists know when something is being put over on them. By way of another example, when incidents of misconduct occur, the chief of police must be able to communicate implicitly and explicitly that accountability mechanisms are in place in the police agency, that members are committed to core values, and that he or she as chief will exercise the leadership necessary to identify the issues and resolve gaps in service. Approaching officer misconduct in isolation of those established systems and processes risks treating the misconduct of the police as something that's just particularistic. Any discussion of professional integrity and thus professional accountability, whether of a police officer, a lawyer, or a journalist, must transcend the individual and the incident to a full examination of the underlying systems and structures. I became renowned in Calgary for saying, we are not investigating just the incident, as important as that is, we are investigating the underlying issues. This focus is well-founded, for throughout, we all must be able to demonstrate understanding of the significant duties that we owe our public. True accountability is brought about by leadership, not coercion, and systems thinking is critical. Integral to any restoration of the public trust is an understanding, as I've said, that true accountability is institutionally centered and culturally driven. It is brought about by leadership, not coercion, and brought about by looking not at the incident arising, as I said, but at the underlying issue that gave rise to the incident. How was it, for example, that the international media hacking scandal was permitted to rise to the apparent proportions it did? Newspaper employees were alleged to have been involved in unlawful hacking, bribery, and improper influence. True accountability is simply, in my experience, not achieved only or at all by laws, rules, regulations, and orders, but by effective and sustained leadership. Leadership which is values-based, focused on people and across systems, is committed to learning, and built on a foundation of ethics. When all was said and done, inquiries in the hacking scandal were aimed at who knew what when. The focus was on the individual misconduct of journalists and the liabilities of employers, not the systemic issues underlying the delivery of news services, at least not initially. Leading change in our institutions to develop the ethical basis that is necessary to prevent such conduct is complex. It requires strategies aimed at ensuring systems within the organization are integrated one with the other and that they are aligned with the public and community needs. Service from the inside out. As I said at the outset, the excellence with which police deliver their services outside the organization is dependent on the excellence within. And the excellence with which news agencies deliver their services is also linked to the excellence within. In my experience, there are some hallmarks of excellent organizations, some of which I've referred to. There's an emphasis on people. Leadership is participative, and it embraces dialogue up and down and throughout the organization. The values of excellence and high performance are the same on the street as they are in the executive offices. The institutional service provider is committed to the public it serves, and it believes in public consultation, participation, and cooperation. And finally, there is a priority placed on continuous learning and systems thinking. Now, the difficulty for me and you as well, I suppose, is that I could keep talking forever about these things. Creation and perpetuation of gender stereotypes by the media and the media and public trust. Neither of these very large current issues is simple. And when there are challenges and actual problems, there is no quick fix, as I've noted. That must not be a route to taking the high ground and the hope in the high ground, like the high ground out west, not the high moral ground. That must not be a route to taking the high ground in the hope that natural evolution will eventually amount to real progress. Our respective institutions, yours in the here and now, and mine, albeit somewhat in the past in my case, have to be aggressive and diligent. And I thank you very much.
So we can take questions now. We have a microphone right there, and if you want to just line up, anyone has questions? I can actually start off with one. And Bob, do you have any questions?
Okay.
Sorry. Do you have a water up there?
Yeah.
That was actually, fantastic and really drew a number of parallels that are very salient to me as an educator in this area that hadn't really been in my mind before. So thank you very much. One of the big questions that it prompts is it comes to a big debate that's happening now in journalism around accountability and transparency. What kind of mechanisms do you imagine journalists and media could put in place to exert the kind of culture of accountability that you're describing exists in police forces?
Well, I'm not as familiar as you with the actual structure of the media. It's always been a bit of a mystery to me as to, how the funders relate to the people in charge, the content and content and so on. So I can't speak from that perspective. But there is no real regulation in your area. Now, I'm not I do practice regulatory defense and corruption and bribery in my law practice. And I understand how institutions and companies become involved in matters of corruption and so on. And regulations don't necessarily cure it because, of course, there's regulations and laws to stop bribery and corruption, for example, in companies and in policing. There's the Police Act and regulations. So if that all worked, then we would never have the problem and have to think about it. So I don't suggest for a minute necessarily that regulation is the answer. But I think there has to be some very careful thinking around the selection of those people, whoever they are, that are in charge, whether they're editors-in-chief or managing. I don't know what the positions are. I never really got an answer when I would ask, so I'm not really sure. And it might be a team-based thing, is it, that a bunch of people decide? Somebody is responsible, though, it seems to me, whether it's at the Toronto Star or at the Globe and Mail or at Maclean's Magazine or at the Calgary Herald or wherever there are, somebody is responsible for leadership, whether it's two or three team leaders or not. And in my view, the selection of those people must be about selecting leaders who understand these issues and who can foster the accountability inside the organization. I do not think that there is any replacement for effective leadership. In fact, I think that what goes on in an organization oftentimes is a product of what is happening at the leadership level. So I know that's not... you are held to account, of course, in the courts, but as we all are.
Please.
Yes. You make an awful lot depend on leadership. Let's take a hypothetical police force in a hypothetical Canadian big city with a hypothetical very powerful police association, a defensive police force close to the outside. It'll never produce the kind of leadership that's going to break this apart. So how are we going to bring about change?
Well, I don't believe that. I don't believe that because you have a powerful police association. And by the way, I was serving in Ontario when there were some pretty significant issues with respect to police associations, and I was deputy chief of the Hamilton-Wentworth Regional Police at a time when the police association was very strong. And there was a strong police association in Calgary. So just because there's a strong police association or union does not mean to say that there can't be strong leadership. What reflection on this issue is that it is absolutely very important for very strong relationships to be built up between the chief and the associations. Now, you might say, well, okay, well, you know, we have meetings, we have a good relationship. Well, I don't, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that police associations or unions, and Alberta is not a very union-friendly province, correct? Ontario is. But I do not think that there is any replacement for the recognizing the right of unions to exist, the right of associations to do what they do, and that chiefs of police and union association presidents and boards of directors need to resolve the issues conjointly, a lot of issues conjointly. When I went to Hamilton Wentworth, I'll reflect on my own experience. I will not talk about some of those that are in the press. When I went to Hamilton Wentworth, there were, as I recall, some 90 grievances and arbitrations on the books. Everything was grieved. There were arbitrations over everything, and it was coming to a standstill. By the time I left, I was in Hamilton for 3 years. We got those down to just about zero. And there was a very strong relationship built with the association over those issues. And I cannot help but reflect, based on my own experience, that some of those, if not a number of those grievances and arbitrations, would never have been launched had the systems in the organization been proper and effective in the first place. In other words, a lot of those grievances and arbitrations were quite proper. Things needed to change. So I guess my question is, why weren't they changed in the first place? Why did it take a grievance and an arbitration? And if you are relating to the association at the level of understanding what the problems are and working the solutions out, you're not going to get quite the same kind of activism. It requires you to think that it's a priority, not a job that has to be done, because the unions and the police associations have a significant influence on the membership of police organizations. So if they have a significant influence on police organizations, why then would the chief of police not spend a substantial amount of time talking about what those issues are and taking it out of the power play context? So that's the best I can do. I do not think it's true to say that you can't be a leader in a context where there are unions. I don't believe it.
Thank you.
My name is Tim Knight. You talk about the importance of leadership, and I've been a journalist for about 50 years or so. I worked 6 countries, very often worked with police. But much more to the point, I've also trained RCMP officers and Ontario police officers, senior officers, and was struck in my actual work dealing with police and in training them with what is perhaps best described as contempt that they have for journalism, for journalists, and for the freedom of information, and the fact that journalists are in public service, just as police are supposed to be. I could bring you a recent example. There was a police riot in Ontario a little while back around the G20. I wonder if you'd comment.
I think that what you're saying about the historical reticence to foster good relationships with journalists is true. I think it's fair to say that I spent a considerable amount of my career fighting that kind of an attitude. I think you're right, though. It does happen in practice. And the difficulty, one of the difficulties is that a lot of times police officers may have a notion about what constitutes a threat or to safety, and not just a notion. They might have formed, for whatever reason, reasonable grounds to believe that there is
some danger in the, lurking, and therefore don't want the press near. And I'm going to take it out of your riot situation. I'm going to go back to my own experience. You'll remember in 1979 the Mississauga train derailment. And you'll recall that there were international media, and for Mississauga at the time it was quite substantial, and the media were brought in right close to the derailment site to see. Now, and there was some risks and so on, but there was a very much more than ever had been in the past open approach to the media, going much farther than they ever had in terms of the scene. Maybe it was because it was of such a large scale that there was not police officers making independent decisions around the matter, right? When you're approaching the scene of a riot, you probably are faced with a police officer who is making an independent decision, potentially, about what the threat is at that particular time, and he's saying you can't go there because there's a threat. And what do you do about it? Well, at the moment of it, I suppose there's not a lot you can do, but I take it back to the organization's perception of the media, the organization's training, the organization's education of their police officers with respect to the role of the media and how they make those decisions and why they make those decisions and whether those decisions are necessary. There's lots of time in police organizations where the media come in to teach police officers how to talk in front of the media. If you get, a camera in your face, this is what you should say and do. Not often are those lectures or training sessions focused on underlying principles. And I think that's one of the failures.
I didn't do that, by the way. I was helping them try to understand journalists. It's a very different sort of thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There needs to be an understanding. I'm saying that the training, sometimes training of police officers can be rigid and rather linear, as opposed to having discussions about underlying principles and issues.
Yes.
Right? And so if you do not help police officers understand that, then it restricts or fetters their discretion when they are making a discretionary decision. I spent a lot of time in Calgary on the front lines and visiting, which is why I was working all night half the time, out in the cars and talking to officers in pizza shops and other places. And it wasn't about, the new program that was going to be started. It was about talking about these kinds of issues. They were conversations that were more principle-based, I guess. I guess I would call it that. Now, you talk to a young officer on the street, he'd probably say, whatever was the chief doing here, right? But they got to understand after a while that I was going there to talk to them, to converse. And that's what's missing.
Tim, with respect, we have somebody waiting there, too.
Okay. If you'd been chief police at the G20, what would you have done?
I'm sorry. Actually, let's move on to the next question, because we also can pick up some questions at the reception afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I'll just very quickly answer. I do not know the facts of the protest or of the event as closely as you would assume that I might, actually, because at the time I was in the middle of a court thing that was. In fact, I didn't look at any newspapers for a few days, and then was shocked to see what it discovered. So I don't really know the facts. So it wouldn't really be fair for me to even pass comment on. I do know about organizing response to protests in general terms, because we had the World Petroleum Congress right after the Seattle riots in Calgary.
Yeah, thank you, Christine. I come from a unique perspective because I'm a journalist, but I also worked at the Toronto Police Force for a couple of years. I just want to ask you about the Vancouver riots after the hockey game. We saw lots of examples sort of a public journalism there. I mean, anybody with a cell phone can be a journalist now,
yes,
right?
That's right.
Taking pictures and stuff like that. What's the role of the media organization? Maybe I can ask Bob as well. What's the role of the media organization and the police when to give up tapes for prosecution of people that were involved in the riots? And where does the media organization go from there and the police?
I just didn't understand. What do you do with the tapes?
Well, yeah, like if CTV is out there shooting the riots and the police want the tapes to prosecute these rioters, where do we go from there? Like if the journalists don't want to give up the tape,
right?
So are there circumstances under which the media should feel the need to just give up the tape as a citizen duty, or does one wait for a court order?
And I think some of them did, didn't they?
Well, I there was lots of horror about what went on, correct, in Vancouver, and the media are every bit as much a part of the community as are the police and the people on the streets and the homeless that are on the streets and everybody else and the businesses. And if that happened in my city, I would like to think that a host of people, including the media, were coming together to analyze the problem and come up with some solutions. And if it meant handing tapes over, then I would hand them over. But I appreciate that you might not have such altruistic feelings, but and maybe you say, well, I'm not going to hand them over unless somebody orders me to hand them over, in which case I suppose the police will attempt to get some kind of order to do that. But really, from a community spirit point of view, I don't think anything is served by holding that kind of information back when the city itself appeared to be so stunned that this kind of event could go on. So I don't have I'm sure the media would have a different view of it, but if I was chief of police and that happened, I would try to work with the media around how is it that I might see your tapes, what kinds of conditions might we put on the use of the tapes, how useful are the tapes, is there some way that we can understand what's on them, what you have, what you need, so that you're not contravening your values. Can we work together somehow on this so that we can move forward? I would try all of that first. And if that, say the media are also part of the community. And if none of that worked and I thought I had a right in law, then I'd probably go chase it.
Well, I mean, I'm not on the bill here tonight because it's Christine's show. I mean, in my own view, which is informed by the pre-social media era, was that we did not turn over holus bolus material unless it was established in law that we had to, and we weren't above the law, and I never sort of conducted myself as if I was, but we were not in the practice of turning over in those days. Usually it was notes, not pictures. But anyway, it's a whole different scene now with the social media.
Well, you know, that's true. But you also don't want to have to live in a community where people are driven by what the law, it's not driven by the law, but driven, you know, they don't do something unless the law tells them they have to do it. I think that there is something about the development and the building of ethical relationships as institutions in the community for the community, and that people and leaders in all of these organizations ought to be able to talk about how it is that they're going to deal with it before just taking a stand. I've seen it, of course, and you have too, in the police. I'm not going to do X because I don't have to do X, or whatever. I don't like that way of operating. I don't like that way of operating in the law either.
That's a good point, especially in terms of public events. I was thinking more of protection of sources.
Oh, right.
And the courts have now
ruled on some of that. Right.
I think we have time for two more questions, so please.
My question is about your being accredited in public relations. I'm curious to know when you became an APR and what was the impetus for it. Was it indeed to deal with the media effectively?
Well, the impetus was this. I joined the Mississauga Police Department when there was Mississauga and Streetsville and Port Credit and Brampton and somewhere else, Chincoosee, I think. In 1974, all of those police, small police departments regionalized into one Peel Regional Police Service. And I recall the chief of the day called me. Mississauga at that time was maybe 100 and something police officers or thereabouts, called me and wanted me to go into, the deputy chief called me and wanted me to go into intelligence. In the new Peel Regional Police. But the next day, the chief called me and asked if I would start was referred to then as a community relations and crime prevention unit. So, you know, you're a young officer and the deputy chief wants you to do one thing, the chief wants you to do another. So the chief won. And I went into, at that time, community relations and crime prevention. And it is a part of who I am that whenever I would get a job of some sort, that I'd learn how to do it. And so the motivation was that how could I possibly start to even understand any of this unless I did this? And so I went and I did the professional accreditation in public relations, because at the time in 1970, whatever it was, 4 or 5, it was the thing that seemed to be available to help me understand what the role was in those days, right? The notion of what that was in those days, the APR was an important thing for me to do, because it's just the way I approach everything. I want to learn, and I want to learn it well and deeply before I carry on. So I became accredited. What I later found out, however, and what my feeling is that if chiefs of police in North America knew more about strategic communications, they would be in a lot less trouble. And I would say that the thing that of all the education and training and things I've done and boards I've been on and everything else, the one single thing that I think served me better through my career was my APR, because it gave me the strategic communications context. And if I had not had that, I can tell you that I would have been falling into lots of hot water plenty of times, just as chiefs all around North America. I'm better than my gun. I'm pretty good with a gun too.
I'll sit down then.
we'll just make this the last question, then afterwards we'll have an opportunity to speak next door.
Hi, great talk, Christine. I'm in the press, and I think to some degree, I think that reporters and police are natural enemies, and I think we work on that for a long time. But what I'm wondering, what do you think about the general state of the nation of, you know, Canadian journalism right now, in terms of what are we doing really good, and, you know, where do we need to improve?
Well, one of the things that I've noticed that is this. Now, I'm not saying this is a fault of the media, though, because it might be the fault of the police. But the journalists that come into, the Calgary Herald, for example, or the Toronto Star, or the Mississauga News, the Hamilton Spectator, they come in, they get on a police beat for a while, and then they're off somewhere else, right? So there's no sort of period of time in which they can develop relationships with the institution. I don't mean unethical relationships. I mean there's no building of an understanding of the institution that you're covering, right? So that movement around, I think that there's sometimes a lot lost by not allowing some of the journalists to develop a real expertise in it might be policing, security, intelligence, those kinds of things, because it may sound easy. It's like saying police budget is something, everybody's got an opinion about the police budget. Unless you understand how police organizations operate and what their systems are, you don't know the right questions to ask. So it behooves the media to develop some expertise in the areas. I think that's one issue. I think that the people who run the media should be more out front talking about what role, if any, they have with respect to the common day reporters. I'm not so sure the public really understands how the media operate on a functional basis, and I think that education of the people is really important.
We actually do have time for one more question. Bob had a question.
Well, I wondered if I could ask you whether these astounding allegations by the RCMP corporal suggest there is a systemic issue there with respect to the RCMP and or policing in general. And secondly, was it a big issue when you were the chief for women?
I'll answer the last question first. There were a lot more people that came forward, not just women, Aboriginal, gay, and others who wanted to say something about the way the systems were running. So I think the fact that I was a woman chief did make some people who had been maybe traditionally, and I say just, you know, historically maligned, not necessarily in Calgary, but just generally, historically disadvantaged groups or maligned groups, it made them feel better about coming forward because they knew that there would be an effective response. So that applied not just to persons like police officers and civilians. It also applied to those who were applying to the police service that were being rejected for a variety of reasons, and I would get long letters and very passionate ones. So these are serious allegations, so I don't know what's happening in BC, in the RCMP, or anywhere else for that matter, but here's what I have to say about it. And I don't know what the RCMP response has been on this issue, other than that there's going to be an investigation. Right? I think they said that. Here's what I would minimally expect. I would expect that there would be an independent third-party investigation, that this would not be a matter, and this doesn't apply, by the way, just to the RCMP. When you have an institution such as the RCMP, and oftentimes even in my law practice, I will advise an independent third-party investigation, because otherwise the complainant is not going to feel as though she's had a fair shake in terms of the investigation. So there needs to be some dialogue around, this is a very serious allegation in the RCMP, and so how should this be investigated? And talking to the complainant about that is something that I would think would be done. So if you're the complainant, I'm coming to you and saying, well, we want you to feel satisfied about how this is being investigated because we hear what you're saying. Have you got any ideas about that? How might we do that? Should we, you know, just have an internal investigation? Should we do a third-party investigation? We will pay for a third-party investigation. So I think that there's a lot that has to be done with respect to how the things are investigated. I think the expertise of the person who is doing the investigation is important. There will be a lot of people that would say, well, the only people that can investigate are people that have police experience, and what good is that going to do if you're investigating something like this? So a lot of attention has to be paid to who is doing the investigation and the credibility of that person. And then once the mandate given to the investigator is important, as you know, mandates, there can be many mandates given to investigators, and the mandate has to provide the scope, not just to investigate a single incident of sexual harassment, but a mandate to come up with recommendations that may or may not go beyond a specific incident. It's back to the old thing about, you know, treating the incident and not even trying to find out whether there's a broader issue. So
separating out the initial charges and whatnot and setting that aside, you think this is prevalent in police forces?
I think that it's prevalent in a lot of institutions, and I can tell you that from my law practice. I have people that come to me that, honest to God, I sit and I think, how can this be going on in 2011? That's what I'm saying. Things have not changed that much. There were a lot of issues when I was in, there were lots of issues. We all dealt with things in different ways. So they must be investigated. And you must not ever turn a blind eye to the fact that it could be more prevalent than anybody is suggesting. And here's something else. It's something like sexual harassment. It's not just sexual harassment, but racial harassment or harassment of gay employees. I just had a client, a transgendered client, that was being harassed. Here's the thing. When the institution makes the a diverse workforce and ethical behavior a priority, then you're going to have the leader, the chief, the commissioner, or whoever it is, maybe in BC, talking about this issue. Like it ought not to be relegated to somebody to deal with as a disciplinary offense. It must be considered to be a priority for whoever is head of the institution, and in this case the RCMP, and other cases other kinds of organizations, must be a priority to not only investigate the incident and deal with that issue from an employee relations, employee management or discipline perspective, but also to ensure that the systems are in place to right what is probably a systemic issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, let me thank you very much, Christine, for really a remarkable talk tonight. It's true that often, and I started my career as a police reporter in Montreal, and it's true that often police and journalists are loggerheads, and the culture seems so different. But the remarkable thing about this talk and sitting listening to it is that you've actually pointed out a number of ways in which our challenges are very much the same and which journalists and newsrooms, media organizations can actually learn from the experiences of police forces. And the ones that I think we might walk away with are, first of all, the obligation that we both have as institutions to be very conscious of the internal biases that we have in speaking about, covering, and dealing with a very diverse community of which we're a part. You talked about gender discrimination in media that you experienced, and I think the same is probably true on a bunch of different dimensions about race, sexuality, and so on, and they're a common challenge we both face. And the other one that I thought was particularly striking was a message about accountability. We deal with them differently because our institutions are different and have different roles in our democracy, but it is a common challenge to both of us, and the question of transparency has become particularly salient to journalists today, because that in some ways is the challenge that's been presented to us through social media. How do we use transparency?
I know you're thanking me, but you just said something that I... there is a mystique which is built up by police and by the media. I'm the detective, right? I know what I'm doing. I'm the media. I know what I'm doing, and there's a fabrication or a mystique building up around all of that, and nobody actually valuing the fact that that there's nothing wrong with the detective telling people exactly what he or she does, and nothing wrong with the media telling people what they do either. You don't have to have this mystique, this mysterious. I'm the police. Believe me, it's like the media. I'm the media.
And because both operate in a community, they're actually often better served through the transparency. So with that, let me thank you very much. Let me thank the CJF. And let me invite everyone next door to speak more with Christine and with each other. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was great.
I might have put you on the spot there.
No, I want to finish what I'm on, and I'll tell you privately. The answer to the question is yes. And the person should be out there saying, I'm horrified. To really stand up and say, and so.
It's not like you were.
Very serious. That's what I'm saying.
I think that they have it though.
Oh, yeah, it's probably your bodyguard, Christine.
What was that?
It's probably your bodyguard kept them out.
Yeah, exactly. One of those five bodyguards.
They finally started, though. There was a bomb set to me. And they finally stopped caring all about these bodyguards when they. She's doing something with women in policing in the UN or something.
I'm Margaret. Yeah, I think you're
right.
No, I haven't, not since she...